This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillig in for Joshua Johnson in Washington. Joshua will be back with you on Monday. It was a holiday week in the United States, but still lots of news to talk about. Justin Amash says adios to his Republican Party. The printers start rolling on the new census forms with only one question missing. A certain flag falls flat for Nike, and the car world loses a legend. With us to catch up on all the week's news, help us digest the biggest stories, those and more, Susan Glasser. She's staff writer for The New Yorker and a global affairs analyst for CNN. Susan, great to have you here.
Thanks so much for being here.
Josh Krausauer is also here. He's political editor at the National Journal. Josh, welcome back.
Great to be here, Todd.
Anita Kumar is here, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico, frequent guest on the Roundup. Anita, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Gang is all here in the studio. It's great to have you all. I want to start with immigration. There was a lot of news on many fronts. It seems like every week there's a lot of news on several fronts with immigration in this country. Let's start down at the border. ProPublica reported a secret Facebook group for Customs and Border Patrol agents this week. It's called I'm 1015. Now, 1015 is the agent code for alien in custody. That's what Border Patrol agents call an alien in custody, a 1015. This group has been around, has around 9,500 members who shared photoshopped images of people like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Members also called Latina lawmakers who would soon visit detention facilities hoes and scum buckets. Posts showed indifference to the death of one detained migrant, and the CBP has announced that it would open an investigation into this Facebook group. Susan, what do we know exactly about this Facebook group? What exactly the language is being trafficked on it, and how many border agents are actually part of it?
Well, I think your introduction suggested the scale and scope of this, which is enormous if you think about how many people have signed up as members and therefore exposed to this kind of language. What struck me in the news accounts of this, the existence of this Facebook group, was that it was known to the leadership for quite some time. This is not something that is a brand new offense, but in fact a problem that has been known about for a long time. And I think the fear, right, and the reason that's resonating so much with people is the question of, is this part of a broader culture of lack of accountability inside the agency, right? There's always going to be examples of regrettable speech. The question is, what, if anything, is done about it? So number one, as you pointed out, 9,500 members, you're talking about a large, large number of people exposed to this. Number two, what are the procedures, if any, and what does it tell you about the leadership of this? Remember, we're at a moment right now where President Trump has made immigration almost the singular focus of his domestic policy agenda at this moment in the U.S. And yet there's been a series of leadership turnovers, a lack of any confirmed existing leadership at the major agencies inside DHS and DHS itself that are responsible for overseeing this. So when an offense like the Facebook group comes out, who's really in charge?
Jeremy Brown Hayes posts this on Facebook. I wish I could be confident that the CBP management will do anything. I am not confident of that. Brandon Judd is the president of the National Border Patrol Council. That's the labor union that represents U.S. Border Patrol staff and agents, the people who are at question here on this Facebook group. He was on Morning Edition, where he asked that the public not paint all of the Border Patrol with the same brush.
Those comments that those individuals stated, they're absolutely 100% inappropriate. But to paint the entire Border Patrol with this same brush due to what three individuals did is absolutely irresponsible. 9,500 people are part of this Facebook page. It was three people that they identified, and those three people must be held accountable for what they did.
Anita Kumar, Brandon Judd of the Border Patrol Union says a couple of bad apples. That's the bottom line here. This is not systemic. This is not Border Patrol wide. A couple of bad apples. There's an investigation now. What exactly does that investigation entail?
Well, I mean, he's right about there's a few people, but to have the scope of thousands of people being members, I think, is something that they're going to have to look at. Well, we don't know exactly what they're going to do, but they are going to look at it, and we are going to probably hear something since it's been such a public issue. I mean, I think the situation is, as Susan said, is that President Trump has, with all these immigration-related agencies, and even the Department of Homeland Security, not had a permanent permanent people in charge. Now, the president likes to have people that are temporary, people that definitely are not confirmed, in part because he feels like he has more power and authority over them. But the problem is there is no sort of accountability. You know, people will say this is the Trump administration, but this has gone back several years and it's thousands of people. So, and it's career people too. So it's not, it's clearly not a Trump thing, but people will paint it as that.
It goes further to the idea, the theme that we've seen more and more of, which is the dehumanizing of people who come across the border, whether that's for politics and political parties, Americans themselves, or in a government agency, whether it's three people or 3,000 people, how those people, those humans who come across the border, are viewed by those who are apprehending him. We got this from Beth on Facebook. I keep hearing them say things like, action will be taken, but I've never once heard those who posted the disgusting and offensive content will be fired. Josh, immigration is hyper-polarized right now. That's not a surprise. We talk about it all the time on this show, and we should. How does this inform the political debate around the border, around detention, which we're going to talk about?
Well, the culture starts at the top, and I don't think it's a coincidence that the president uses very dehumanizing rhetoric, uses very polarizing rhetoric when talking about migrants, when talking about illegal immigrants. And you look at this Facebook page, and you have even a few people, without any criticism internally, joking about the deaths of migrants. The Republican Party was once known for compassionate conservatism, and there's a notable lack of compassion when you hear rhetoric from Trump's Republican Party these days. The politics on immigration, though, is very complicated because you have polarization on both sides. You have a Republican Party that is focused on border security, that wants money for a wall, that really wants to take a tough stance on illegal immigration. And then you have the ascendant progressive wing of the Democratic Party that wants to, you know, decriminalize illegal immigration, that wants to, you know, a lot of Republicans call it open borders. And there's not a lot of middle ground on immigration. You can see why, when you have an issue that's about values and not about self-interest, that both parties are so far apart and how they view the same situation.
Well, here's another thing that will inform this very debate. Lawmakers visited the border. A lot of what ProPublica reported on this Facebook group was in anticipation of lawmakers visiting. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was one of the lawmakers who did visit. She immediately took to Twitter after her tour of detention facilities at the border to say that she felt unsafe during that visit. She also said that she saw migrants drinking from toilets in detention. The CBP has flatly denied that accusation. But Susan, what do we know about the facilities that lawmakers toured? These questions come up week after week about exactly how migrants are being treated. We see a lot of downplaying by Border Patrol and Customs, a lot of downplaying by the administration. But it seems like witness after witness who goes there reports something very different.
Well, that's right. You know, this facility in Florida, the Homestead facility, I believe, you know, is one that a number of Democratic members of Congress have gone to. They've come out with horrifying reports. They've talked about people who were behind glass walls that were holding up notes, begging them for help. There was one account that I found sort of chilling and kind of notable of a group of children who were encountered by the members of Congress who said, "How can we help you?" You know, you're certainly seeing enormous overcrowding. You're seeing reports of grown-ups and children who are starving, who are very hungry, lack of access to sanitary facilities, just an extraordinary things. If this was being written about in any other country, what would be the takeaway of it? And so, again, but just to go to the politics, because I think that's very important, why are we talking about this so much right now? That is what President Trump, by design, from the beginning, he has a perception that he's winning on this issue, even to have us talking about it, even to have Democrats criticizing him. He believes that benefits him. Certainly, the turn to the left in response to largely, one could argue, a kind of crisis of the administration's own making has been something that Republicans have welcomed. When you saw in the Democratic debates over two nights earlier or late last month, you saw Democrats essentially saying we would give health care, we would give access to illegal immigrants, we wouldn't punish them to Republicans. That embroiders and adds to the narrative of Democrats as being in charge of being in favor of open borders.
So, and will likely be a campaign ad when those hands went up.
There's just no question, number one, it will be a campaign ad. But number two, again, I'm struck by the fact that this is a crisis of our own dysfunctional political making. Remember that the big picture here was that immigration and illegal immigration was going down in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. When Donald Trump came to office talking about immigration, there wasn't a crisis. Through a series of political confrontations, including most recently a funding crisis, that was the stated argument. Remember, it's only been a couple of weeks, but that was the argument about why so many children were being held in such appalling conditions in Texas was, well, the appropriation hasn't come through to take care of these children.
And then the money came through, and we'll see if that actually makes a difference. It's good to talk about the politics of this. After a short break, I want to get back to conditions in those detention facilities. There was more news this week. Before we do take a quick break, Susan mentioned politics, Anita. Democrats control the House. Do they have the power to really change any of this besides rhetorically?
No, they don't, because obviously the Republicans control the Senate. And even when one party controls both chambers, they cannot solve this immigration problem. They haven't through the Trump administration, the Obama administration, the Bush administration. It is something that's very difficult. And with divided government, it's just not going to happen.
We'll talk more about detention at the border after this short break. It's the Friday News Roundup on 1A. We're wrapping up the week with Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico, and Josh Krausauer, political editor at the National Journal. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. It's 1A. It's the Friday News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick. There was some more good news on the economy this morning as U.S. employers added 224,000 jobs. That's well above the pace that a lot of forecasters had been expecting. The monthly snapshot for June from the Labor Department showed unemployment rising slightly to 3.7%. Let's press on with the rest of the news on the News Roundup. A reminder, our guests this week, Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker and a global affairs analyst for CNN, Josh Krausauer, political editor at National Journal, Politico's White House correspondent Anita Kumar is here as well. I want to return to detention at the southern border of the United States, because there were more data, actual data, this week from the U.S. government. Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General issued a report on Tuesday urging immediate action to address overcrowding and squalid conditions in our detention facilities at the border. This report finds that more than 30% of children are being held longer than the 72 hours allowed under the Flores Agreement. That sets the standard for how we treat minors in custody at the border. Children also had no access to clothing changes or showers, even though they may be detained up to 2 weeks there. The facilities did not offer hot meals. There were many, many other findings as well. Detainees begging to be released when inspectors visited them. Adult detainees with no place to lie down in detention, having to stand up in crowded cells, no place to lie down on the floor. In other cases, if they could lie down on the floor, no beds, concrete floors where detainees in the United States had to sleep. Susan Glasser, these findings, they don't come from politicians. They don't come from partisans. They don't come from warriors in the immigration fight. They come from the Inspector General.
Well, that's right. This is our own government, attempting to hold itself accountable. And, you know, you mentioned those findings. I think there's a certain numbness that comes from having so many outrages. But I'm haunted by the images of these detention facilities that they released along with this investigation, which document in a powerful way exactly what those words are telling us. For example, there is a photograph that was released that shows a portrait of a cell so overcrowded and a group of men standing in front, and you realize they can't sit down.
It looks like a subway car,
yeah,
at rush
absolutely.
Hour.
There's too many people there. They can't sleep. This is what is the description of every human rights nightmare in what we're used to thinking of in other countries around the world. So how did this happen in the United States in 2019? Who is accountable for it? And what is going to happen as a result of this? If we weren't so enmeshed in a partisan and divided situation, this would be the only story that we would be talking
about. We got this tweet from JCB. When will people realize that the conditions in detention facilities mirror those in our own prisons? This is not a new development, but a business plan. Josh, to the point, why isn't there universal outrage to this? There's outrage in some corners of our politics. Of course, there's outrage on social media, outrage from some politicians. Why isn't there universal outrage? We're talking about children and adults in overcrowded conditions who can't sit down.
The sad reality is that we're so tribal, we're so partisan that even outrageous conditions at these camps are responded to in along partisan lines. But you know, the reality is that the conditions in these camps and these holding facilities is largely out of bureaucratic morass. You have an infrastructure that hasn't kept up with the level of migration. You have 800,000 asylum cases that are pending. It takes an average of 700 days to process each case, and you've had a pickup in the level of migration in the last year or two. And you also have, I mean, the rules in these facilities, you're only supposed to be able to hold the migrants for 72 hours. Many of them have been there for over a month. So some of this, I mean, there are certainly partisan reasons for people to take the positions they do, but some of this is just the sheer slowness of the bureaucracy.
It seems like there's two things going on here when you look at this. There is an overcrowding crisis at the border. Josh is right. There are people coming over the border in numbers the system cannot handle, thus overcrowding. Alongside that, something we talked about before the break, the dehumanization of people who come into this country. It seems like, at least tacitly, that the policy from the top of the government of this country is the dehumanization of these people. Those two things go alongside one another. Don't they?
Yes. I mean, we are hearing, as Josh mentioned, that rhetoric that we've been hearing for the last couple years. But let me tell you what Republicans, or at least Republicans close to the president, say about this. They say, well, see, we told you that there was a crisis. There is a crisis at the southern border. And this is the result of that. So if you had listened to us and done what we had said, we wouldn't be in this situation. Now, obviously, that's not the case. This has been going on a while. They have not come up with solutions to solve all these problems. But that is what's going on, is it has become so black and white when it's really not, right? You didn't solve it. Here's what's happened.
Susan.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that some of this actually is by design of the administration, okay? So this is not just like, oh my goodness, all these people came and we simply were overwhelmed, okay? So there's a calculated, not just political, but policy decision and series of decisions by the Trump White House to escalate the conflict in hopes, in some ways, of producing exactly the political response that we're seeing right now. For example, the president has consistently and untruthfully said that the policy of family separation was one that originated in the Obama administration. That is not correct. Why are they saying that? Well, first, the administration lied and said that there was no such policy last year. Then they said, we're ending it. Then they said, well, we're reconsidering starting it. And by the way, it was started by the Obama administration. Well, the answer is that there is a policy decision to aggressively ratchet up every kind of enforcement action possible, while at the same time there remain these resource constraints and too many people in the facility. So if you change the policy metric, right? You say we're going to hold more people for a longer time because we're going to be getting tough. At the same time, you don't have more resources into it. That's when you actually are producing more overcrowding and more of these human rights violations.
Before we move on from immigration, because there is so much news this week, like every week, I want to hit on one more story briefly. Anita, the Department of Homeland Security sent notices to immigrants this week ordering them to pay fines for nearly $500,000 in some cases for failing to follow deportation orders. That's controversial. Is it legal? What's the policy?
Yeah, apparently it is, but it's not used. It's a very rare thing that's done, and obviously these people cannot pay these amounts, these exorbitant amount of money. This is another tactic by the Trump White House to basically say, looking back, President Trump, you've seen all these changes at DHS and all these agencies. He is incredibly frustrated that he has not been able to solve the crisis, or at least do what he said he would do. Clearly, he's not solving the crisis, but just take some of these actions he said he would. He said he would do that in 2016, and they are looking at everything possible now to try to get tough on immigration, and this is just another way that they're trying to do that.
Let's take it back to Washington, D.C. We are, after all, on the tail end of a holiday. It's sort of a quasi-holiday this Friday. A lot of people probably are taking the four-day week. There were quite a few departures from tradition in the 4th of July celebrations in Washington, D.C. It was our 243rd birthday. President Trump had his controversial salute to America kind of tacked on to the public fireworks display on the National Mall. There was a roped-off section for the president's friends and donors, some military hardware on display, some tanks, some flyovers with military jets. So, Josh, in the end, how did it go down? There was a lot of consternation ahead of time.
Well, I think this was classic Trump in that this administration tried to project chaos. You had a lot of worry that this speech was going to be all about Trump and it wouldn't honor the principles of our country and the founding of our country. You know, in reality, if you looked at the text of the president's speech last night, it's a patriotic speech that any president could have given. He referenced the heroism of civil rights activists, of suffragettes. It was an honor to the, you know, a tribute to the military. So, look, some of the tactics, some of the practices of having a cordoned off section to donors, of having tanks on the National Mall. I think there were just two of them in the end. You know, that was a little bit abnormal. But in the grand scheme of things, I think a lot of the opposition worked itself up on something that we'll forget about in a couple of days.
Just maybe as the president wanted, maybe all by his design. WAMU's LEU spoke to protesters and attendees here in Washington, D.C., down in the mall, including this woman who just became a citizen along with her son.
I think it's awesome. It's great to see all the military might around. You don't get a chance to see it. So this is awesome that we get to see the birds in action.
We got this email from Jill in Alabama. If the president wants to showcase appropriate weapons of destruction, he should have displayed muskets and cannons, spoken about America's determination to throw off the yoke of tyranny. America works best when we're all working together. And Anita, Jill's critique there, a lot of people had, which is the president can have an event if he wants to. It seemed like his tactics were designed to divide, at least at first. Maybe in the end, if you read the speech, you would have said, well, like, that's okay. Nobody expected it from him. Some people forget about the weapons and the flyovers, who said this is just supposed to bring everybody together. There shouldn't be this angst around the fourth.
Well, by the mere fact that you're right, the speech in the end, patriotic speech, but the fact that he put himself in there, right? It was designed to put himself in there. He was the center of attention. He gave the speech. He made the fireworks longer. He brought the weapons out there, you know. So it was all about him when other presidents haven't done that. So that's the number one thing. He did want it about him. This is a president who wanted it to be about him. He's running for re-election. He wants to be out there. But you're exactly right. If he didn't want to divide, he knows how divided this country is. He wouldn't have done that in the first place.
How much do we know about the cost in the final analysis, or do we?
We don't yet. We have seen different numbers, but there's all sorts of contradictions on what's gonna be the tab for this.
A controversial 4th of July here in Washington, D.C. A little bit of controversy around a certain Republican, meanwhile. Sorry, former Republican, no longer a Republican. His name is Justin Amash. He's from Michigan, from rural Michigan, and he made headlines a couple of months ago, maybe 6 weeks ago. He became the only Republican in Congress to support bringing impeachment proceedings against President Trump after he read the Mueller report. Well, Justin Amash has now officially quit the Republican Party. He made that announcement on Independence Day, maybe his own Independence Day. Get it? Drawing ire from the president, who tweeted, told his followers that Justin Amash was, quote, a total loser. Josh, you follow Republicans closely. Why is Justin Amash leaving the party? Why not stay in the fold and fight it out?
Well, one major reason is that he would likely have lost a Republican primary, because the new rule of Republican politics is if you speak critically of President Trump, your support will diminish overnight. We saw that with Mark Sanford, the congressman from South Carolina who lost a primary to a more pro-Trump challenger. We saw that with Jeff Flake, Bob Corker in the last election. He was only polling at 17% in the Republican primary, and according to a recent poll. So this is partly in reality to the political fundamentals in his district. But, you know, this is someone who was always a libertarian Republican. He's someone who stood by his principles no matter how unpopular they were. And at one point in time, he was the person viewed as sort of a right-wing extremist. He was voted against giving federal workers back pay after the shutdown. He was someone who didn't want to support government assistance to the Flint residents after the water crisis because he doesn't believe in government spending for local projects.
What you're saying is he's not leaving to become a Democrat.
He's not going to be supported by the Democrats either. So this is a guy who stands by his principles no matter the consequences. In this case, he was willing to speak out against Trump, willing to support impeachment hearings. And I don't know if he has a career in the Republican Party or in politics.
The road to Republican Party headquarters these days is littered with the political carcasses of people who did not get behind President Trump. And you listed some of the names: Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, Sanford of South Carolina. Justin Amash still survives because he's still a member of Congress, but he might be the next one. Well, let's stay in Congress for a couple of minutes, because there is a long battle on the House side, at least among the Democratic majority, to get their hands on those tax returns that belong to President Trump. It took a significant step forward this week. Here's another congressman. This is Dale Kildee. He's a Democratic member of the House Ways and Means Committee. He's on CNN talking about why his party is now suing the IRS and the Treasury Department to get those tax returns.
We're not going to let this go. I think the chairman has handled it in the way that he should. We are now in court, and it's going to be up to the court to determine how quickly they move. I hope they move with some haste, because this is a serious question.
Anita, how did we get here?
Well, there were a lot of people saying, Democrats saying, that the chairman didn't go fast enough, right? We're already in July. If he had started this process earlier, then perhaps they would have a chance of getting the tax return sooner if they win. There are a lot of people that are worried that the tax returns, if they get them, won't come nearly fast enough, might not even come before you know, the president faces his reelection in 2020. So we're at a point where, as you know, the Trump administration in various ways has said it is not going to cooperate with House Democrats. And so this is one of those times where the House Democrats have gone to court. There's actually going to be a lot of those times. But there is a big divide in the Democratic Party about whether they should have moved faster.
Well, here's another one of those times when they're going to court. The Trump administration announced earlier in the week that they would not press ahead with plans to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. That was after the Supreme Court rejected the White House's bid to include that question. But then the president tweeted something very different. He said, "It's so important for our country that the very simple and basic 'Are you a citizen of the United States?' question be allowed to be asked in the 2020 census. Department of Commerce and the Department of Justice are working very hard on this, even on the 4th of July," end quote. Susan Glasser, the government said, "We're not going to do this." The Supreme Court said, "You can't." And then a tweet out of the White House seems to have tossed everything into disarray.
Well, it's a classic example of Trump-era chaos generated by tweet. This is a new factor in American government. Obviously, we've never had the President of the United States publicly not only making policy, but contradicting his own officials, including the Commerce Secretary himself, who had said that the census would proceed without the question. So it's a new dynamic. There was, I think, something that's destined to go down in the annals as a classic of the genre, when a government lawyer was called to account in an emergency conference call by the Maryland judge supervising this case, said essentially, "I have no idea what's going on. I'm trying very hard, as I'm sure you understand, to ascertain what exactly our policy is." There was lots of commentary on Twitter saying, "We are all that government lawyer at this point. None of us know what the policy is." This is, needless to say, not at all an example of exactly what Chief Justice John Roberts was trying to address in his ruling for the majority on the Supreme Court, which is to say, where is the deliberative due process? Where is the administrative decision making that gives us a legitimate rationale for this? Obviously, a tweet is not really a deliberative process.
And that government lawyer trying to figure out, along with everyone else, what was going on. We got this correction from June, who puts me right. Justin Amash is not from rural Michigan. He's from the Grand Rapids metro area. Thank you, June. I got that wrong. We're going to take a short break. My guests, Susan Glasser, Josh Krasauer, Anita Kumar. But before we take a quick pause, We're going to join those who this week carved out a new path for singer Patti LaBelle. No, really, a new path. Patti LaBelle now has her very own street in her hometown of Philadelphia. It's a stretch of Broad Street that was renamed Patti LaBelle Way during a ceremony on Tuesday. So the next time that you're in Philly, remember to wind down the windows and sing a little bit of hey, sister, soul, sister, flow, sister, a little bit of that. Voulez-vous? This is 1A. Stay close. It's the Friday News Roundup. Susan Glasser is here. Josh Krausauer is here. Anita Kumar is here from Politico. And if you're listening in the car to us right now, you're most likely experiencing the influence of a man named Lee Iacocca. He died on Tuesday in his home in California. He was 94 years old. Iacocca was the face of the Detroit auto industry in the post-war era. He was a celebrity CEO in this country who first became well-known in 1964 as the man behind the famous Ford Mustang. Well, after leaving Ford, Iacocca went to Chrysler, where he helped save that company from bankruptcy in what's remembered as one of the most remarkable turnarounds in business history. When the company was struggling, he cut his salary to $1 a year. Lee Iacocca was a team player, and he became the face of Chrysler on TV commercials, where he appealed directly to the American driver, usually ending with a signature catchphrase.
If you don't agree they're the best Chrysler's ever made, the very best America has to offer at a sensible price, then I'm in the wrong business. Oh, one more thing. If you can find a better car, buy it.
The U.S. auto industry certainly looks a lot different than when Lee Iacocca was at the helm and when he took over Chrysler. No one has quite taken his place as that celebrity CEO. And Josh, you told me in the break that Lee Iacocca once had political aspirations.
People wanted him to run for president. He was so beloved in the mid to late 80s that there was talk about recruiting him to run for president in shades of Donald Trump's 2016 campaign. He actually was a very successful businessman at the time. The American auto industry was really struggling against Japan. And he reinvigorated Chrysler. He made it a competitor once again. And he is beloved in the American auto industry for that very fact.
Those boxy, terrible American cars of the 70s were not selling, and the quality was awful, and Lee Iacocca knew they couldn't compete with Japanese cars, and he helped to turn that around. Well, let's move on to another iconic American company, making news yet again, as they tend to do. Nike has dropped a pair of kicks that featured the Betsy Ross flag this week. That design detail triggered a huge amount of pushback, and after that backlash was the backlash to the backlash. Susan, what is happening here with Nike back in the news again? Why exactly are people upset on either side of this issue?
Well, you know, I mean, welcome to the culture war circa 2019. It makes you nostalgic in a way for the trade wars of the 1980s, which, by the way, just to connect these two conversations, you know, Lee Iacocca's America and the struggles of the American auto industry in the 1980s were a profound political influence, it seems to me, on Donald Trump. And if you notice, he's still obsessed with the use of national power and tariffs, in particular in defense of America's auto industry. It occupies an outside place in his political imagination, I think, because he was so shaped by those fights of the 1980s. So he still talks about Japan and Germany as ripping America off and as, you know, that his big threat that he often deploys against both Japan and the European Union, which really means Germany, is to impose tariffs on their auto industries, because to him, that's almost synonymous with national power.
And when he says that, it really does feel like the 80s. You know, we haven't clashed with Japan on technology for 30 or 40 years.
Right. I was just a kid in high school then, and you remember protectionist lawmakers on Capitol Hill taking sledgehammers to Japanese-made technology. So that was sort of the 1980s version of the politicization of business. Now, here we are, flash forward in 2019, where you have these political fights over essentially identity politics, history, race, and culture being played out in the realm of business. And that, I think, is what's going on with this Betsy Ross flag on the Nike sneakers. You have Colin Kaepernick, the NFL player, complaining about this, saying essentially this is a reminder of a time when slavery was prevalent and among the original 13 states. And then, as you said, there's the backlash. So now you have outrage conservatives embracing the use of this flag. And I have to tell you, for me, as I imagine for a lot of people, it's just overall a turnoff at a time of such crisis. Is this really what people want to be talking about?
Yeah. I feel like there's a little bit of deja vu here. I mean, boy, does Nike love being at the center of controversy. This keeps happening.
Well, that's a good point.
And each time it does, it feels less and less like an accident, Anita. I've hosted this show before, guested for Josh, and a couple of times ago there was a Nike-Colin Kaepernick controversy. Now, I don't take away from Colin Kaepernick's sincerity in his politics. Of course he's sincere. But this is corporate America, and here we are. What are we talking about? Nike. Hey.
Well, there's a lot of companies that would say they don't want to be involved. They would just not even go out there.
Nike leans in.
Yeah, they have clearly decided that controversy is good. All publicity is good publicity, right? So they're out there. I mean, it must have obviously cost them. They produced this shoe and sent it around the country.
I don't know. Maybe the publicity pays for itself, doesn't it? I don't know how it works.
Well, they're clearly one of the companies we have today that is not shying away from controversy.
Josh, do we need to be a little more media savvy the next time there's a Nike controversy around a pair of shoes or some kind of culture war flashpoint? I feel like I've been here before. I'm starting to feel like a little bit of a tool to Nike.
Well, I think there's a political lesson to be learned, which is that the base matters more than the average voter, right? And if you polled the country and asked what they thought about the Kaepernick controversy, I would bet that overwhelming numbers of Americans would be against Nike. But for Nike's purposes, by trying to inculcate their brand with younger consumers, with African-American consumers, they think this is a net asset to them. This isn't about what they, you know, trying to be idealistic. This is about just pure corporate greed, corporate, you know, trying to make a buck. And they think it's better to play to their base than it is to play to the entire country.
Well, regardless of Nike's politics, and that's their business, I think it behooves all of us to remember what Josh says, which this is about the bottom line. Every time you get riled up about one of these controversies on any side of it, who are you helping? Maybe you're helping Nike. I don't know. Something to think about it. But I want to stay in the sports world because we had some great American news from over the pond in England. Let's talk about tennis. Let's talk about Wimbledon. Let's talk about women's tennis on the grass. Corey Gauff is a name that you're going to be hearing a lot more about. She's better known as Coco. She roared into Wimbledon this week, and the Coco train, folks, shows no signs of slowing down anytime soon. Here she is.
Obviously, I literally got my dream draw, so I'm just super happy I was able to pull it out today. And she played amazing and was just super nice. And she's always been nice the couple times I met her.
Who is Coco talking about, Susan Glasser? Who did she beat that she is speaking of so reverently there?
Well, she's talking about the legendary, the one and only Venus Williams. And, you know, this seemed like a moment in a way of handing over, passing of the torch, whatever you will have it, between two incredible American sports figures. Women's tennis is, you know, been enriched, as we all know, by the Williams sisters. And, you know, here you have this incredible kind of 15-year-old phenom. You know, tennis, especially women's tennis, has long been the province of super talented teenagers. I'm old enough to remember back in the 1980s. We're talking about the 1980s when Tracy Austin, I believe, was a 16-year-old superstar winning the U.S. Open. So it's one of those, you know, great moments in women's tennis. And it reminds us that, you know, there's something to feel good about.
Coco defeated Magdalena Rybakova and Venus Williams, you mentioned, to continue advancing. Now, the Williams sisters, they changed the face of this game, both in America and for the world. We talk about Venus Williams, her sister Serena, if you want to compare the two sisters, an even greater champion, arguably the greatest athlete in American history. We have that fight, hard to compare them. How important was it, do you think, for Venus Williams' defeat at Wimbledon to come at the hands of another young black female player, another rising phenom on the American scene, who I guess you could argue the Williams sisters set the table for her. I mean, she worships them. That's who she came up idolizing.
Well, that's exactly right. Look, sports is often a young person's game, and it's been an incredible period of dominance for not one but two Williams sisters. So I think that it's a key moment. You know, tennis was historically not as much of a black sport until the Williams sisters. You know, of course, there was the legendary Arthur Ashe in men's tennis, but I think it just speaks to this being, thank goodness, a different era in our sports and in our public life.
Let's return to immigration because we're getting a lot of listener comments and people responding to our discussion on that. I mentioned at the top of the show how quickly, I guess how quickly this debate continues to move in this country. In one sense, Anita, quickly, in another sense, it goes nowhere. We talk about comprehensive immigration reform, which hasn't had a serious consideration in Congress since, you could argue, 2009, the last time a serious effort at reform was on tap. Democrats who are running for president seem to be veering pretty far to the left at this point in the primary. We're pretty clear that the president is going to make a huge central theme of his reelection campaign that border, those people coming in, closing the border, the country is full. Where does all this head?
Well, both parties are divided on this issue, and that's the problem, right? As I mentioned earlier, even when one party controls both chambers of commerce and even the White House, they can't get anything done. And the reason is the Republican Party is divided on how to handle this issue and the Democrats are divided. So while you hear the president on one hand and you hear the Democrats running for president on the other hand, let's remember that the Democrats that are running don't represent every Democrat and the president doesn't represent every Republican. The problem is when you sit down and you deal with something so complicated and there's so many different issues on immigration. It's not just one piece. It's not just the border. It's not just asylum. There's so many different pieces. They'll come up with 50 different answers. And they just cannot rectify that. They can't come to terms on that. So we're going to hear about this for the next year and a half. This election may be about immigration, but there's still really no future here. In no immediate future are they going to solve this problem.
Well, here's what goes to the division that Anita's talking about. Constance emails us. Trump likes the outrageous conditions in which migrants are held. He actually said, and I'm paraphrasing here, if they don't like the conditions in detention, they should stay home. That's how the president answered his administration and its treatment of migrants. But Penny tweets this, I'm a Democrat, but I cannot support open borders. We need comprehensive reform. We cannot absorb the world's poor. And Josh, a lot of people watch that Democratic debate, watch Democratic hands go up when a reporter asked, would you be for decriminalizing illegal crossing of the border? And some hands went up and they said, oh, Republicans are salivating at that response because the average American voter, I suppose the average American white voter, does not like that.
Yeah, this is an issue where neither party is responding to the majority of voters. And the irony is that we've had comprehensive immigration reform proposals go through Congress, had public support behind a lot of the key proposals behind it, but couldn't get passed through a Republican-controlled House most recently. So this is the state of our politics. You have an energized base on both sides that really control the dialogue and can obstruct, compromises. And you have gridlock. You have this gridlock, which is very real human consequences at the border.
Susan?
Well, I think I wanted to point out your tweeter or commenter made actually an important point about the administration looking to achieve in some ways exactly this outrage as a warning to people. That was the stated interest in the original family separation policy by the Trump administration. The president was a believer in the idea that essentially ratcheting up the pressure, doing something so outrageous as to separate children from their families might be the deterrence that they needed in order to shut down this flow of migrants from Central America. So that was actually the stated goal in some ways of the family separation policy. As far as the Democrats go, I think Josh is making a very important point that both parties at this point are being pulled farther and farther to represent their own bases. Immigration didn't used to be so hypercharged. And recently, had a fascinating conversation with a former very senior official in the Bush administration. Here's a what if. President Bush, George W. Bush, was a supporter of comprehensive immigration reform, as were many leading Republicans at the time, along with Democrats. What if he had chosen to begin his second term after he was reelected in 2004? What if he started 2005, not with a doomed push to reinvent entitlements for the next century, which didn't go anywhere, But with comprehensive immigration reform, it likely would have passed, and we might not be where we are right now.
And I would also like to say, when people say you're pulled further and further by your base, to a large extent in politics, you're not a victim of your base. You create your base. Keep that in mind the next time you see a politician pulled one direction or another by their base. Well, I want to end quickly on some great American news, hopefully coming from France. This weekend, FIFA World Cup final is on at 11 a.m. Eastern. The U.S. women are in the mix.
One of the best team. I mean, for me, it's the best team.
They are the best players. I don't know why, but they are very different. That's why we support the USA.
This feels like our year. This just feels like our year. We're happy. The girls are relaxed. I don't know. I'm super excited.
Josh, is it our year?
It sure feels like it. And the victory over Britain 2-1 was made sweeter by Alex Morgan, one of the star players on the U.S. soccer team, doing a proverbial sip of the tea.
We have a Brit in the control room who's doing a tea motion and is not happy about it, I want to say.
They're playing the Netherlands Sunday. Megan Rapinoe is slated to be back. She didn't play against England. She's the star player on the U.S. team. But this is going to be, I think, a high point in American sports.
Oh, we're all rooting for Team USA facing off against the Netherlands on Sunday. Don't miss it. It's going to be phenomenal. Megan Rapinoe back on the field. It just couldn't be more exciting. Well, I want to thank you all for being here. And before we go, I want to send a little bit of condolence out to people whose spirits might be a little bit down. That's because bourbon distillers have had a tough year. They're contending with the economic consequences of the president's trade war after doing very good business the last few years. Whiskey exports slowed in 2018 after our trading partners introduced retaliatory tariffs up to 25% on America's whiskey. Well, this week, a fire at a Jim Beam warehouse in Kentucky destroyed about 45,000 barrels of bourbon. Word among insiders is that lightning may have been the cause. The good news, no one was hurt. And despite the fire, the loss accounted for just 1% of Jim Beam's total inventory. There is still plenty of bourbon to go around in America and for everyone here at the table, if that's your thing. Some people, Anita's looking at me sideways. I don't think she's a bourbon person. I want to thank you all for being here. Susan Glasser, Josh Krasauer, Anita Kumar of Politico. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
1A's digital team is Catherine Fink and Gabby Healy. Our lead engineer and sound designer, Jake Cherry. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us. This is 1A.